Hello and welcome to the Run Today podcast. I'm your host, Nick Simmons. With me, as always, is Cam. Cam, how are you?
I'm great. It's a beautiful day here in Oregon. We're looking at the mountains, the trees.
You're just good now because we just got off the phone with Alan Stein Jr.
You loved this one, didn't you? Yeah, this was an epic conversation. I almost didn't have words because I was like taking so much in. There's so much knowledge and wisdom you guys are going to find from this podcast that I think is really going to inspire you to live a life that is moving towards being your best self.
Authentic too. Yeah. I mean, this is a guy that went through some pretty tough things in his late 30s, a career change, a divorce. And he said, I'm just going to start fresh and I'm going to, you know, continue to pursue the things that I'm most passionate about, the things that I think can help the most people.
Yeah.
And now he is a world famous public speaker teaching people about the unseen hours, about cohesion, accountability, culture. Mm-hmm. We dug into a few of the things that he talks about when he's on stage, but more than anything, I think we just kind of teed it up and let him talk about life. And he's just full of so many nuggets of wisdom. It's almost like every single time I asked him a question, he went off in a direction that I didn't necessarily expect him to go, but I was so glad that he went there.
Me too. It was so good. And one of my favorite things from this is when he talks about being the best version of yourself and every decision you make, reflecting it on who that person looks like. Okay, if I'm going to eat this McDonald's today, is that the woman that I want to be in the future? You know?
Yeah.
So I think even those small decisions we make every day have such a huge impact on who we want to become. So recognizing that is huge in our journey.
Yeah. Alan, he is, he's about to give you about, what was that, 30 or 40 minutes?
30 or 40 good minutes.
He's going to give you 30 minutes and really listen through this one because I think, especially towards the end, he gets into some subjects that are just very, very self-reflective. He's definitely a guy that sat down and said, what do I want out of life and how can I get it? So without further ado, here he is, Alan Stein Jr. All right, here he is coming to us from the DC area. It's Alan Stein Jr. Alan, how are you?
I am fantastic. How are you guys today?
Oh, we're great, man. How's DC? You're in Maryland, right?
You know, I am. I'm about 30 minutes north of DC, and we've actually been having some very pleasant, almost Oregon-like weather the last couple of days because it's been very low humidity, and it's usually really sticky this time of year. So it's been nice to have a little breeze, a little sunshine.
Yeah. Every time I come out that way, it's usually in the summer, and it's just unbearably humid. So.
Oh. Yeah, glad, the humid makes all the difference.
Oh, yeah. But it's a beautiful part of the country. You get out there, you run Rock Creek Park, or you go out to the coast, and I love that part of the country.
Yeah, it's a good gig. I sometimes take for granted because I've lived here my whole life. So anytime I'm talking to somebody else, they always talk about how wonderful the area is and how much they love to come visit.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a little numb to it because that's how I feel about other places.
Yeah, grass is always greener, right?
Totally.
Did you grow up in Maryland?
I did. I actually grew up where I am now, where I live now, right in Gaithersburg, and ended up playing basketball down at a small school in North Carolina. So I was gone for 4 years in the late 90s. And then I moved back here after that, and I've been here since. My family's since moved away. My parents retired and moved down to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and my brother moved down to St. Augustine, which is just south of Jacksonville. So everybody left me, but I'm still here and I've got my kids here and things are good. And since I get to travel the world doing what I do, I'm fine wherever I hang my hat because I still get to experience a lot of other places and do and see a lot of other things.
Yeah, absolutely. The college that you went to down in North Carolina, what was the name of it?
So it was Elon College at the time. It's now Elon University. So it's a small school, small private school, about 30 minutes from Greensboro and Durham. And it was the perfect buffer for me because it was about 4.5, 5 hour drive from where I grew up here in Maryland, which was a good enough distance where I felt like I was autonomous and on my own and away from my parents, but at the same time, close enough that I could come home and certainly they would make trips down to watch basketball games and so forth. So
well, and plenty of good basketball down there.
Oh, tons of good basketball. Absolutely.
And so did you have aspirations of playing after college or were you down there really to focus on your academics?
Well, it's always funny when I look back on my childhood, of course, when you're really young, you have an incredibly narrow view of the world. You really don't know what's outside of your own neighborhood. So in elementary school, I'm thinking I'm going to be an NBA player. That was my goal. And then certainly as I got older and in high school realized that playing at that level was more than likely not in the cards, but to be able to play small college basketball would still have been an awesome opportunity to play the game I love, have somebody else pay for my schooling. So it worked out well, but no, the writing was definitely on the wall for me that once college was over, my playing days would be over and then had to figure out exactly what it was I was going to do with myself after that. And thankfully basketball still played a major role. As I look back, basketball was my first identifiable passion and I fell in love with the game at probably 4 or 5 years old. And here I am 4 decades later and basketball still plays a very pivotal role in my life. So I'm very grateful to have made a living and a life around something that I'm passionate about.
Yeah, it's funny. When you're a kid, you think, oh, I'm passionate about the sport, so I have to be a pro to or a coach to have a future with this. But I know, having come up through professional track and field, and Cam's brother knows, having come up through basketball, that there's a million and one ways to continue your passion and your career around a sport. You know, I love AJ, Cam's brother, who is now an influencer on YouTube, making incredible basketball-related YouTube content.
Yeah.
And I'm just so inspired by Gen X and Gen Z and what they're doing to redefine what we can do in the space of sport.
Me too.
So, but we didn't have the social media that we have today back when you were coming out of college. As you're transitioning from Elon College and looking to what you're going to do now as a young professional, what were the avenues that were open to you, and what were you most passionate about?
Well, both of my parents were in elementary education for 30 years. So I grew up with a very strong appreciation for teachers, for anyone in a position of servant leadership. And as I was entering college, I saw how much my parents enjoyed their job, how much purpose they found in it, that they loved pouring into young people. So without much direction, I went into college thinking, all right, I'll be an elementary school teacher, and then I'll coach basketball. And when I got into college and started doing some of the student teaching, I realized quickly I was not near as passionate about the teaching portion as I was the basketball portion, and just learned from my parents that you have to be all in with a vocation like teaching. You know, owe it to the young people that you're guiding, that's not something you can kind of go through the motions on. So as soon as I realized that I was not passionate about teaching and I knew I had to make a pivot, the next logical choice was the performance training space, the strength and conditioning space, because that was something in my junior year of high school I really started to adopt for myself. Like many players that are 16, 17 years old, around the 6 foot mark, of course, my number one goal in life was to be able to dunk a basketball. So, you know, I was spending countless hours doing different types of training programs and so forth to be able to jump higher. But I really started to get an affinity and an appreciation for the training side of it and for the conditioning and improving power and agility. So when I graduated college, I just decided that combining my love of basketball with my newfound love of performance training, strength, conditioning, fitness is what made the most sense. And I kind of dove headfirst and really just became a basketball trainer. And while that is fairly common today, it wasn't very common in the late 90s and early 2000s. In fact, at that time, less than a third of NBA teams even had a strength and conditioning consultant.
Wow.
And that person usually was the lead personal trainer at the nearest Gold's Gym. It wasn't even someone
that's crazy to think about today, just 20 years later.
I know. Well, think about that. I mean, think how far it's come. Now NBA teams not only have a strength and conditioning coach, they have an entire performance department and staff with 20 to 30 people in it. So it's come a long, long way. But so really, in essence, when I graduated, I was a quote unquote personal trainer that was specializing in working with youth basketball players. And was able to carve my niche in that for just over 15 years and had an absolute blast on that ride, and then was just ready for a change. So 3 years ago, I decided to take everything I'd learned through the game and apply that to business in the form of a professional speaker.
You know, I'm always really curious about big changes like that. The transition from college to young professional life can be really tough for men and women. And you obviously did a great job parlaying your passions and creating a job out of it. Then how do you decide, hey, it's time for me to do that yet again? You have the successful career as a trainer. You've carved out your niche. How do you say, you know, it's time to make another move? What was that like? What was the conscious decision? And at this point, you have a wife and kids at the same time, which changes things. What was the dialogue going on at the time?
Well, you know, it was interesting when I graduated college, and I firmly believe this, I'm in my early 20s. I have a very low cost of living, because when you're in your early 20s, I mean,
you can survive on nothing. Yeah.
Top ramen.
And sleep on a couch. You can live on a few bucks a day.
You nailed it, which meant it was very low risk for me to go into basically a full commission business, which is what personal training is if you're not working for someone. And I was okay with that, because at that point, like you said, it was low risk. And worst case scenario, I crash on someone's couch and I eat ramen noodles, which I was willing to make that trade if I was pursuing what I loved. And thankfully, you know, business grew, things did well, and I didn't have to sleep on anyone's couch or eat ramen noodles. So I kind of conditioned myself to being someone that was on a full-time commissioned-based business. And that's what I've been my entire life. I mean, I've never had a corporate job. I've never had a salary. So 15 years later, when I decided to make that leap, even though the stakes were much higher because I had children and so forth, it's all I knew. So I was, it didn't seem like a risk to me. I think it would have been much riskier You know, if I had worked a normal job in a cubicle from 9 to 5 and had benefits and a salary and then said, you know what, I'm going to quit this and try this speaking thing, it was natural to me. And I knew how much I had learned building up my training business that I was going to be able to apply to the speaking business. So I still saw it as low risk. But to answer your question, the reason I made the pivot was very similar to the reason I got out of elementary education. My passion was starting to wane in the basketball performance space. I just wasn't as excited to help players run faster and jump higher as I had been years prior. And once again, I knew that I owe it to the players I was working with to be all in. So when I felt myself starting to head towards burnout in that specific domain, I thought, okay, where can I utilize my skill set somewhere else? What's something that's going to invigorate me and excite me? And decided to make that leap. And then one more, I guess, piece to the puzzle. I'm very amicably divorced now. And I lead with amicably because my ex-wife and I, we get along great. We're good friends and we make excellent co-parents. But it was right all around the same time, right around my 40th birthday, which is when most people have that so-called midlife crisis. I was going through a divorce. I was finding that my passion was waning in the thing that I had been doing for 15 years. So I just said, you know what, I'm going to make a clean sweep of everything. I'm basically going to start
reset
over.
Button.
Yeah. And it was so invigorating for me to say, I'm going to start over personally. I'm going to start over professionally and let's just have at it. And I really didn't think twice about it. And thankfully everything's worked out. My family relationship and my relationship with my kids is outstanding. Business is booming. I made the right choice, but most importantly, I'm incredibly happy. I'm very fulfilled with what I'm doing, and I have a high sense of purpose with what I'm doing. So I've got everything in alignment. Now it's just a matter of continuing to try to level up and be a student of the game and get better at my craft.
Well, I think that's kind of the new school way of thinking. It's understanding that humans do burn out in careers and humans do sometimes grow apart. And I think it's so admirable that you recognize that both in your professional and your personal life. And I think the older generation maybe was of the mindset, hey, you just finish what you start.
Stick it out.
Maybe stick out a career for 40 years that isn't right for you, or stick out a relationship for 40 years that isn't right for you.
Yeah.
And I think it takes a lot of bravery and a lot of hard work to recognize when something's not going right and take that jump. And you said, you know, you made the right choice. I think you made a choice and then you made it the right choice for you. And it's something that's done through a lot of, you know, self-reflection and hard work. Mm-hmm. So hats off to you, Alan, man. Impressive to hear you at 43, so happy and so successful, especially knowing what you have just recently come through.
No, I appreciate that. And you're right. It does take courage just to make a decision to kind of go against what the rest of the world is doing, to kind of zig when most people zag. And I agree with you. I think part of it is generational. Both my parents, for the most part, had one job for 30 years and then they retired and they're both still happily married. It's been 45 years.
Since, wow.
And so I think some of that is generational. And yeah, for me, life's the most precious thing we have. So I try to spend as little of it as possible doing things that I don't like or don't want to do or things that make me unhappy. And it's something I try to model for my children. I mean, certainly the hardest part of the divorce in particular was the thought of what could this be doing to our children. And ultimately, her and I both decided that us being happy, even though it meant separately, and modeling that is one of the best gifts that we can give our kids. And to say, hey, we entered into something, it didn't quite work out the way that we thought, but we own it, we don't make excuses, and we're going to pivot and move forward accordingly. But the only way that I can be the father that I'm capable of is if I'm as happy and as fulfilled and trying to seek my purpose to the highest level. And if I can do those things and work towards being the best version of myself, that's who I want to be. And from my vantage point, I would not have been able to do that had I stayed married. And I would not have been able to do that had I stayed on the career track that I was on. So once again, it made making those decisions in my mind, I mean, less of a decision. It's what I had to do.
I love that we had a guest on the podcast that said, you got to put your own oxygen mask on before assisting others.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that makes so much sense to me. And it sounds exactly like what you've done. And now you are out helping others. Tell us about this idea, you know, as things are unraveling, but you're also thinking, hey, I've got this passion for public speaking. Of all the directions that someone with your skill set could have gone, what was it about public speaking that you said, this is the way I want to really pursue? Well, this is what I want to pursue. This is where I want to put my time and energy.
Well, I got a good taste of public speaking towards the end of my basketball run because I was speaking at a lot of clinics and I was teaching coaches how to train their players. So as far as being in front of audiences and using spoken word as my primary tool, it's something that I knew I had an affinity for. It was something that I was fairly good at, even though I didn't have much coaching at the time. And it was something that I enjoyed. I don't have a musical or rhythmic bone in my body. So this is as close as I'm going to get to being a rock star, being on stage and talking. And it's an amazing feeling. It's almost an intoxicating feeling when you're sharing something you're passionate about and you see on the audience's faces and in their body language that they're finding value in it and that these nuggets are going to help them inch forward to being the people they want to be. It's a really powerful feeling. And I don't take that for granted. My first mantra as a speaker is it's not about me, it's about you. And that's speaking to the audience. So while I have things that I believe most people would find value in, it's all about delivering a customized message to the audience that they find value in. And Louis C.K., the famous comedian, said something to the effect of, if the audience doesn't laugh, then it's not funny. Like that's the only definition of funny is whether or not people laugh. They're the judge and jury. And I look at the same thing with speaking. I could get off stage and think that I delivered an amazing talk, but if it didn't resonate with the audience and it didn't solve any of their problems or hit any of their pain points, or they didn't take any notes, or they didn't find anything practical that they can apply, then I totally missed the boat. And to me, that's what's fun about this is it's almost like a Rubik's Cube. And I'm trying to figure out with each audience, what do they need to solve their problems or get where they're trying to go? And how can I share that and communicate that effectively? And it's an incredible feeling.
I love that. So when you were doing these presentations as a performance coach, you know, you're learning to be on stage and you probably had a couple scripts that you were using or kind of a playbook that you were going off of. How do you then say, I'm going to take this to another stage, you know, and what is your content? What is those first few speeches like as you're trying to find out, like you said, what makes the audience laugh? What makes that audience resonate with what you're saying? How did you create that? Basically what I would call your brand.
Sure. Well, the first thing kind of happened through fate. And I remember it vividly. I mean, this has just been about 3 years now, but I was in Germany speaking at a big basketball event, and people in other countries tend to gravitate towards anything basketball related that comes out of the United States because of the NBA. So I'm speaking over in this country, over in Germany at this event. They're treating me like a rock star because, you know, I've met NBA players. I mean, it's everything that you should want to be able to do in the position I was in. And I just found myself not that excited to be there and not that excited to speak. And that was when it really, the red flag went up and go, okay, man, if you're not excited to be here, then you need to find something else to do. Yeah. And then funny enough, about a month later, a friend of mine reached out and said, we're holding a huge fitness retreat for all of the employees in our fitness business in Jamaica. And we need a leadership speaker. Is that something you'd be interested in doing? And I was like, well, yeah, you had me at Jamaica. Yeah, sure. I'll be there. And I went down and gave what I consider now my first quote unquote corporate talk. And of course, looking back on it, it was fragmented. It was unpolished. I mean, it was the best I was capable of doing at the time. But with the 3 years of hindsight under me now, I realized it wasn't that good. But I just remember how I felt when I stepped off that stage. Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt electric. I felt like it was all signs were pointing towards, okay, this is what I need to do now. And basically on my flight home, I said, okay, this is what I'm going to pivot into. Now, I can't just quit everything basketball related and start this tomorrow. I need to phase out over the next few months. So while I'm still honoring some of the basketball agreements I had, I started meeting with a handful of my friends that were entrepreneurs, that were executives, that worked in companies. And I started just asking them question after question of, what are the types of things that you guys need to improve your leadership, to improve cohesion amongst your colleagues and coworkers? What things to improve culture? What things about my past that you know of do you think would be valuable to your business and to the corporate world? So I was just basically asking several people, at least a dozen, what do you think I have in my toolbox that the corporate world would find helpful? And they started sharing some things. And when I started to notice some tendencies, I realized, okay, there's a market for what I have to offer. And there's some people that may find value in this. And then I took a few weeks and just did massive brain dump after brain dump, where I was writing down every story, every stat, every lesson, every interaction with coach, like anything that I could think of that I experienced in the basketball world that I thought could be translated to the corporate world, I just started creating this massive file and then started to see where those things overlapped. Here's what a bunch of people are telling me the corporate world needs. Here's a bunch of stuff that I've experienced and learned. And now let me see where those things intersect. And that will at least make up the foundation and the skeleton, the playbook, if you will, of how I would start my speaking career. And then the next step, I'm a huge believer in repetition, and that the only way you get good at anything is to get reps. And I know that, you know, I can practice as much as I want in my living room, but if you want to get good at speaking, you got to get in front of audiences and you got to speak. So I reached out to many of those same folks in the business world and said, would you be cool for me coming speaking to your people for 30 or 40 minutes for free? I just need to practice this. And because I had built solid relationships with them and because they had believed in my message, they gave me some opportunities. So I was able to start getting out there and working on material, seeing what worked, seeing what needed to be refined, seeing where there were opportunities to do more stuff, and then just slowly started piecing it together. And then quickly started hiring some coaches to help me with speaking. And fast forward 3 years, and it's all coming together now, all of this stuff. But I was very methodical and very strategic in how I made that leap. I didn't just turn in my pink slip and the next day just run out on the street and try to start speaking to random people. I really tried to approach this in a strategic manner.
A lot of what you said there just kind of boggles my mind how smart of an entrepreneur you were. I mean, coming from your background, you wouldn't have known this, but you went out and did what very seasoned entrepreneurs do, which is test the market, identify something where there's a lapse in the market, that the amateur entrepreneur creates something and hopes that there's a market for it. The experienced entrepreneur goes out and actually finds out what the market needs. So I don't know where you got the idea to do that, but absolutely brilliant. And you clearly found a niche. And I also loved what you said about repetition. This is coming from a guy who probably seen a lot of free throws in your lifetime. And you understand that it is all about repetition. I think so often we don't want to start something until it's perfect. And that's just, it's impossible. You can't make it perfect without actually going out, getting your hands dirty and practicing.
And just like you said, with entrepreneurship, I mean, you have to be prepared to launch a product or service before it's fully refined.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you need to make sure that it's good enough to get out there.
But it's always a work in progress.
And it'll never be perfect.
That's the true secret, right? It's never perfect. R&D always has to be done. You can always be better.
Exactly. But you want to be able to, listening is one of the most important skills, not only for a leader and an entrepreneur, but even as a speaker. I mean, one of the most important things is the pre-event call that I have before I do an event, where I just ask them question after question of what it is their audience needs. What would make this a home run? What takeaways do you think? What do you want them to be able to do differently after I speak? And being able to listen to those answers is no different than putting your product out there and then listening to the consumers on ways to tweak it and make it better. So
when every audience is different, you know, and whether you're pitching to a Fortune 500 company or a startup, you're going to have to tailor that a little bit. But there are some underlying threads, and you mentioned a couple of them: cohesion, accountability, culture. Every single company has these aspects. Mm-hmm. It may be their own recipe, but how do you go into, you know, after that pre-speak call where you talk to them about their culture, their team, how do you go in and then start helping them to strengthen themselves in those areas?
Well, you just said it so perfectly. I mean, thankfully, there's going to be a handful of pillars that are going to apply universally. I mean, these are the things that have the highest utility. I mean, no matter what company you're talking about, they're always going to need to focus on leadership and focus on culture and focus on accountability and focus on standards. So the big pillars are going to be in place no matter what. So that's kind of, that will always make up the skeleton of what I present. Then the rest of it is what needs to be highly customized. And it's so important, especially from a communication standpoint, that you speak their language. So I research the company. I try to talk to as many people as I can just to get a feel for the right terminology, because the goal is, I'm clearly an outsider coming into their business, but the goal for me is for me not to feel like an outsider, for them to be like, man, has this guy been working for us for 2 years and we didn't even know it? Like,
you know, their inside jokes, you know.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And I tell you what, the more of that you can do, then the more buy-in and believe in that you'll get from them. So it's even something as simple as, do you call them customers or do you call them clients? Mm-hmm. I mean, in essence, it's the same thing on a macro level, but if you're talking to someone that calls them clients and you're in there giving a speech and you're saying customers, there's just this slight disconnect.
You're not speaking the same language, yeah.
No, and language is so powerful. So those little things, that's the customization. And of course, when you're talking to a group, each one's going to have their own little issues and own little problems and pain points, and that's what you want to address in some of these supplemental ways. But for the most part, it's usually under that big pillar, and it doesn't matter the size of the company. They're all experiencing some of the similar things. Scaling certainly makes things more difficult. It's easier to lead a company of 20 people than it is to lead a company of 20,000.
Sure.
However, the fundamentals don't change. Even the fundamentals of what it takes to play in the NBA are the same fundamentals that it takes to play in high school. You just have to do them at a higher level and with more power and strength and speed. But I mean, dribbling is dribbling, shooting is shooting. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing, whether you're talking to a company of five or a company of 500, it's the same foundation. It's the other stuff that we have to make sure is getting customized and individualized for them.
I love the analogies from basketball. When you are talking to a company, big or small, how much of your basketball experience are you bringing into your speech?
A good portion of it. Now, when I'm doing my due diligence, I always try to get a feel for, is this a company that has a strong background and appreciation with sport and with basketball? Like, are these already my tribe?
Yeah.
Or are these people that I have to do a much better job explaining why something that works in basketball would always also work in business? So, but that's my job. My job is to be able to translate that. I very much consider myself a performance translator, if you will. So someone that doesn't like, watch, or care about basketball, I need them to still reap all of the benefits of the stuff that I share. Now, it's an easier sell if you like basketball, because that's where most of my experience comes. But as I'm getting older, also make sure that I shift and I share parenting stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, a good portion of the people that I speak to are also fellow parents. And that's something else that's kind of a connective tissue between us, where they can go, okay, this guy's kind of like me. Oh, he's a father. Oh, he's kind of like me. And we build these things that get them to lean in a little bit more. So depending on the group will depend on if I do more basketball stuff or less basketball stuff, but I also don't shy away from it. I mean, that's my past. It's my unique selling proposition, because my journey is different than most of the other speakers out there. So I'm proud of it and I lean on that. However, I don't want that to be the reason that I don't work with a group, because they think, well, we don't like basketball and he's just a basketball guy, so this won't be a good fit. So I work hard to not just be the basketball guy.
I think that's smart, and it opens you up to so many more opportunities. And I think sport in general, if you look at it on a macroscopic scale, sport's something that everybody understands. Mm-hmm. Team building, perseverance, overcoming obstacles. I mean, it just, there's so many metaphors from sport that we can carry over. Now, there is one thing that you mentioned in your book, Raise Your Game, and I want you to dig into it a little bit more. It's about mastering the unseen hours. What do you mean by that? These are the hours where we're not on the court, the hours where we're not in the office. How do we take control of those hours?
Well, you know, with basketball, what we try and tell folks is a real player is made during the unseen hours. And in basketball, we're talking about the hours where the gym lights are off, the referees aren't there, the cheerleaders aren't dancing, the cameras aren't rolling. Like, that's when you develop yourself as a player.
For sure.
When the lights come on, that's simply when you showcase all of the work that you've put in. Yeah. And it's the same thing with really in any area of our life. Even for me, the hour that I'm on stage is simply a result of the thousands of hours I've put working on my craft and rehearsing for that and customizing that talk. That's just the part that people see. But whether or not that talk's going to be successful is determined well in advance of me actually turning the mic on and stepping on stage. So, and it's the same in any area of our life. You know, if you're going to run a staff meeting, what did you do during the unseen hours to prepare for that staff meeting, to create the agenda, to figure out what, you know, the topics that you need to address, to figure out how long you're going to spend on each one, to figure out who should be invited to the meeting? Because there's no sense in inviting people that don't need to be there, then you're wasting their time. So there's so much stuff that goes behind the scenes that most of the world does not see. And yet that's the stuff that's most pivotal to us being successful. And of course, one of the changes to that now is with social media, where there's more things seen because more people are documenting their own unseen hours, mm-hmm. which is a whole different conversation, because I've always been of the belief, if you're spending all of this time documenting your workout, then you're probably not working out very much or working out very hard. In theory.
But if it doesn't get posted
on the bus.
If it doesn't get posted on Instagram, did it ever really happen?
Yeah, it's the old tree falling in the woods analogy.
Exactly.
I'm with you. So it is different. I do think, but this is also good, because if you follow the right people, some people in your space or have mastered a craft, hopefully they actually do post some of the things that they're doing during the unseen hours to give you that glimpse. Because I've been behind the curtain with some of these NBA guys, if we were in the NBA season right now and the Golden State Warriors played tonight and Steph drops 40 points and has 8 threes, most people just look at that and are in awe that he's able to do that.
They assume he's just, God's gift to basketball.
Yeah, it's natural.
He didn't shoot 10,000 3-pointers when he was a kid every year. And
exactly. Or even 1,000 that morning.
Yeah.
In the pregame shoot around. That's the part. And I mean this is the best compliment I can give, while sometimes it gets taken out of context. If you knew the type of work that a Steph Curry put in during the unseen hours, it makes scoring 40 points a lot less impressive mm-hmm. because you know what went into it. Yeah. And yeah, if you're like, well, yeah, of course, if he shoots a million shots, he's probably going to score 40 one night. It's not that surprising.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's surprising is that more people don't follow suit.
Right.
That more people don't put more effort and time during the unseen hours when that's the surest way that you're going to have the desired outcome that you want. And even
success,
then, it's still not guaranteed. Yeah. So to me, that's those unseen hours are vital to all of us. And that's what we have to ask ourselves. What are we doing during the unseen hours, since most of the outcomes of what we're trying to achieve are during the seen hours?
Alan, you'll appreciate this one. It used to rub me just so raw. I come from the world of track and field, and they would break down what Usain Bolt made per second when he ran a sub 10, uh-huh. a sub 10 hundred. Like, well, he made $1 million and he ran it in, 9.5. So he's making $100,000 a second. I'm like, okay, now amortize that over the decades, decades of years, that he was out there working so hard in the gym and so hard on the track. It suddenly becomes a little less impressive from a dollar per hour standpoint. Still very impressive what he's doing, but think about the unseen hours before you start chirping cute little $100,000 a second.
Yeah. Absolutely. Quotes. And it's so funny because that directly correlates into the speaking world, where someone will say, you make $15,000 to give an hour talk. Well, that's what it seems to you, but do you have any idea how much time goes into that hour talk? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't just wake up that morning and give an hour talk.
Hundreds of hours to get that ready.
Well, of course. I mean, there's the specific time that you're working on that specific talk and the pre-event call and the customization. Mm-hmm. But then, yes, as you just said, you're constantly working on your craft. So anyone that's a really seasoned speaker, I mean, they've been doing this for a lot of hours, and they've given a lot of free talks, and they've done a lot of things for a lot less than that money. And it's not to say that it's still not great compensation, but as you just said, people, they're forgetting what it takes to do that. And it always reminds me, I'm sure I'm butchering it to some degree, but it was a story about, like, Picasso was sitting outside at an outdoor cafe, and a lady recognized him and asked if he would draw something for her son on a napkin. And he did, and took him about 3 or 4 minutes. And she said, well, how much do I owe you for that? And he said, I don't know, like $5,000. And she's like, well, $5,000, it took you 3 minutes to do it. He said, no, it took me a lifetime to be able to do that in three minutes. And that's ultimately the difference.
Bingo. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. So what's the future look like for you, Alan? I mean, I go back to that transition, that brave moment you had when you said, this is something I've grown out of. Do you see yourself ever growing out of speaking, or do you see yourself pivoting in a different direction? Where are you at right now, kind of in this meteoric rise as a public speaker?
My guess is speaking will always play a role in what I'm doing, just because I really enjoy it. But I don't know. I mean, if you would have asked me 10 years ago if I was ever going to leave the basketball space, I'd have said, no way, man, I'm riding this horse until I'm 70 years old.
Yeah.
So you don't know. I know that right now I'm so focused on the present. I don't get distracted by the past, and I try really hard not to get anxious or worried about the future. I mean, I try to prepare for the future, but I don't get caught up in it. So it's funny. People say, what is my 5-year plan or 5-year goal? And I don't even know. I know that I'm fully committed on continuing to get better at the speaking craft and to serving bigger and better businesses and audiences all over the world that I can. And that's where my focus is. And the moment I wake up and I'm either not enjoying it, or I don't feel like I'm getting better at it, then I may pivot to something else. But right now, I'm just having an absolute blast. And that's where my sights are at present. But who knows? And what I always tell, and I tell this to my kids all the time, what you need to do is you find what you're passionate about, and you find what you're pretty good at. And then you find where those two things intersect. And that's your strength zone. And that point of intersection is where you're going to, if you invest most of your time there, it's where you'll be the happiest. It's where you'll be the most fulfilled and influential and successful. And for 15 years, that intersection was smack dab in the middle of basketball performance. And now for me, because my interests and passions have changed, because my skill sets have changed, it's right in the middle of professional speaking. But who knows where it'll be 5, 10, 20 years from now.
I think that's incredible. I just want to share a quick story with you, because I think that we think a lot alike, and you might commiserate with me a bit on this. My dream from the age of 13 on was to be the best runner I could be. And I'd sit through class, think about how bad I wanted to run and how bad I wanted to stand on the Olympic star line, how bad I just wanted to be the best runner I could be. Made two Olympic teams, was living the life, had the sponsors, had the travel, had everything. And I remember about my late 20s, early 30s, just being invited to Monaco, Madrid, Shanghai to race for big money, and just thinking, God, I don't want to do this. Yeah. This just this sounds horrible. Like the last thing I want to do is get on another plane. The last thing, and no, this is Cam actually came on a few of these trips. Cam, I said, I can't go back to Monaco. Yeah. I won't go back to Monaco.
Which like, for any other human, they're like, human, we don't like, get
I'm
it.
Like, I'm like, I know you don't get it. It's just, I'm so over it. Yeah. And we, as humans, we get over things and you just have to have the bravery and the conviction to go in a different direction and make it the right choice. And Alan, you've done that multiple times. So I'm sitting here saying like, I don't know where your path's going to lead, but I know that you will always make it the right path for you. And I'm very inspired by your story.
No, I appreciate that. And I appreciate you sharing that. It's one of the cool things is with anything we go through in life is to realize you're not alone. None of these problems are unique to any one of us. I mean, we may internalize them different, but it's nice to be able to share things like that. Because I would imagine on some level when you were doing some of that soul searching, at least I was too, was like, dude, Alan, what is wrong with you? How are you not how are you not finding enjoyment in this? You know, 20 people that would kill to be in your position that would want to do these things.
Yeah.
And then, but then you have to realize that this is your journey. And it's one of the main reasons not to play the comparison game, which is a game that most people choose to play. And I think social media was almost invented to escalate it. But it doesn't matter if other people want to go to Monaco or other people want to
run. You gotta live your own truth.
Yeah, you don't. And now it's time for you to say, all right, well, on this track and field journey I've been on, I've developed some skills that have very high utility that I will be able to apply in other areas of my life. Now let's go fishing for some other areas where I could apply this and where I will enjoy it and find the same enjoyment that I used to find in running. And you've done that. And that's all any of us can do. But you know, it's one of the things I encourage people to do. I mean, really the only way you can become the best version of yourself is if you're doing what you love and you're doing something that you feel has a purpose, a greater purpose than yourself usually. And that's the key. And whether that changes every 3 years or every 30 years doesn't really matter, but you have to have the self-awareness to recognize it. And I want to make sure too that we're not talking about just a couple of days where you're just not feeling it. You have to really know in your heart that it's time to make a change. I love being a speaker, but I'm not pretending that every second of my life is puppy dogs and ice cream. I mean, there's always going to be
ups
things
and downs
here and there. And you know, it's midnight and you're stranded at an airport and you're like, oh my God, this sucks. But generally speaking, you should know inside of you, are you on the right path or do you need to make a change? And because life is so short, I mean, we were talking before about life expectancy. I just don't see any point in continuing down a path that you've already established is not the best fit for you. Once you make that decision, it's definitely time to take a U-turn or go off on an exit ramp.
I go through my own, you know, ups and downs, and I rely on the people closest to me, the people like Cam and her dad who know me best, my family, you know, and I say, hey, is this me at the end of a path or is this me in need of an attitude adjustment? And I think the people that love us and know us best can sometimes help us figure that out. For you, it sounds like that moment you had in Germany where you're like, everyone would give their left arm for this experience and I don't want to be here. For me, that Monaco experience, when you come to the end of a path, it may be a path made of gold bricks, but it might not be the right one for you. So I love what you said about not throwing in the towel early, but we have to identify when we're at the end of a path.
Most certainly. And that just takes constant reflection and constant awareness. You know, I've always felt that very similar to fitness, self-awareness is not something you ever arrive at. It's a constant work in progress. I mean, you can't just wake up one day and say, all right, I'm physically fit. And then stop eating well and working out because then pretty soon you won't be physically fit anymore. And it's the same thing with awareness. The moment you think you've mastered self-awareness, then you're going to stop doing the internal work and the reflective stuff that you need to do to maintain it. So it's just, And a lot of this also has to do with, and I'm sure you experience the same thing, as giving yourself some grace and some compassion. Don't beat yourself up because, like I said, there was a lot of guilt involved in me leaving a space that I had worked so hard to build a name in and that so many other people wanted to be in, but I just had to own that I'd done what I was going to do in that space. I'll be forever grateful for the relationships I made and the opportunities I had, but it was just time to shift. And who knows how many more times I'll shift in the next however many years I'm going to be alive, but I know that I'm paying attention to it and really just kind of let my heart and my quality of life be my number one guide. That's what's most important to me. If I'm consistently doing something that I'm not happy doing, that I'm not getting fulfillment from, or is lowering my quality of life and is not in alignment with my beliefs, then it's absolutely non-negotiable. Got to move on.
I love it.
That's good.
Right. Yep. Alan, you're spitting like just nugget.
So much wisdom.
Yeah, so much wisdom left and right. I wanted to talk to you for another hour, but we don't have the time for it. We can follow you on social media. You're at Alan Stein Jr. on all platforms. We will link that in the description here on the show. And the book is Raise Your Game. Alan, man, this has just been awesome. And also the website, of course, Alan Stein Jr. If people want to hear you speak, or specifically if some of our listeners want to bring you in to speak, where's the best way for them to reach out to you?
Yeah, there's a contact form on alansteinjr.com, or they can just hit me up on social and we can connect. If they are interested in the book, they can go to raiseyourgamebook.com. And yeah, man, it would be great. I love talking about this stuff. I truly appreciate an opportunity to share with your listeners and be a part of your platform. And, you know, kind of the last thought I'll leave you guys with, this is one of the tools that I think has helped me the most, is I have this vision of who it is that I want to become. Like, who is the man that I want to be? And what is it that I want to accomplish? And then every decision that I make in my life, I run through a binary filter and say, is doing this going to take me closer to who I want to be? Or is it going to take me further away? Is making this decision right now, is this going to get me closer to what I'm trying to achieve or further away? And then clearly, the more times you can say yes to that and do it, then the closer and more efficiently you'll get to being there. And none of us are perfect. None of us should even strive for perfection. We should all be much more interested in progress than perfection. But even the littlest things matter. I'm about to eat a big old pile of junk food and think, well, is eating this junk food, I want to be someone that is mentally, physically, and emotionally fit. Is eating this meal take me closer to being that guy or further away? And I'm not saying to not enjoy your life or to never eat junk food or to, but you need to do so sparingly if you're really committed to becoming that person. And I found that my life has become so simplified because that's how I make all decisions. Everything I do in my life, I'm like, is this taking me closer to who I want to be? And I would say 85 to 90% of the time, I opt in the direction of what'll take me closer. And the other time, it's either I made a mistake, a miscalculation, or sometimes you just want to have that burger and fries. And there's nothing wrong with that as long as you know that it was a conscious choice that you made
you're owning
your decision. Yeah. And that's really what I'd love to leave your listeners with, is figure out who you want to be and then make decisions in alignment with that. And as basic as that premise is, we all know that that's not easy to do, that there's plenty of temptations out there that go against the grain of who we're trying to become, but it's out there for the taking and they're all choices for us to make.
Love it, man.
So good.
Great, great place to end on. Alan, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your wisdom. We'll be sure to check you out online and have a great day. Go enjoy that sunny weather.
That Oregon
yeah,
weather.
Exactly.
I will do that. I appreciate you both immensely. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Talk soon.
A big thank you to everyone for joining us on that episode. If you want to find out more or listen to other episodes, go to rungum.com/podcast. Also, please make sure to subscribe on iTunes or your preferred player. I'm Nick Simmons, and you've been listening to the Run the Day podcast. Until next time.